Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record program number 1340. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 14. This is being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2024. And, when people hear me laughing, it just reminds me of one of my favorite lines from the great philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who observed the quote, "A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling." And I have a lot of feelings dying as we get into the research. You know, a couple of points just right off the top of my head. I want to encourage listeners who have not done so to get the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my life's work on it, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. And I get no money whatsoever from this, but one of the books that's available is the book Undercover by the late John Roy Carlson, a pen name for a guy named Edward Jerumian. And one of the things he talks about there is the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, who's very, very well known for the book The Power of Positive Thinking. He became a mainstay of Reader's Digest and Saturday Evening Post. He also, in the World War II period, fronted for a key Axis spy, primarily German spy, named James Edward Rumley, or maybe it was Edward James Rumley. And it was Norman Vincent Peale who married Donald Trump and his first wife, Ivana. And Ivana Trump has communicated, she's no longer alive, but she wrote that, or told the journalist, I can't remember which, but that Donald Trump had a copy of the book My New Order, a collection of Hitler's speeches intended as a sequel to Mein Kampf, and kept it in his nightstand for late-night reading. Of course, Ivana Trump was not around for the hearings into the January 6th, 2021 insurrection. She conveniently died ostensibly by falling down a flight of stairs and suffering a fatal contusion to her upper torso, her chest. Off the top of my head, that sounds really unlikely. If one were to fall down a flight of stairs, I think one would hit an extremity, either break a limb or perhaps suffer a fatal head injury. A fatal contusion to the chest does not sound like something you would sustain falling down a flight of stairs. I wonder if she was basically dispatched, so she could not contribute information. But anyway, if people think all this stuff was very long ago, far away, it doesn't matter. No, it's not so long ago, and it's not far away at all. But Monty, go ahead. Now, you gave us a brief taste. Continue.
Well, essentially, I'd like to pick up where I left off about Frankhauser and, seemingly being involved in these, fledgling neo-Nazi precursors to the American Nazi Party in Germany. And then, his purported activities seemingly played out with FBI informants in 1967 under the guise of the Garrison trial, demonstrating that he had, in fact, successfully infiltrated the national wing, as it were, of the Young Socialist Alliance in New York, and in turn the Socialist Workers Party on its National Steering Committee with his own personal informant, George Larrabee, a.k.a. George Payne. And I'd like to move forward with some of the other organizations that Frankhauser is in liaison with when he's developing these leftist credentials in late 1959.
Go ahead.
So, after returning to Reading from the United States Army, or Reading, excuse me, from the United States Army, Frankhauser began reading SPSDF literature. That's Socialist Party, Socialist Democratic Front literature.
Monty, let me interrupt very briefly. Well, from what source are you reading now?
Oh, well, this is the same source that I referenced earlier. This is from Roy Frankhauser's FBI interrogation that was conducted 9 June 1967. It's the same FBI report.
So this is an FBI document from
June 9th of 1967, roughly around the same time. In fact, it's the exact same time that he's infiltrating Jim Garrison's office, acting as a field investigator for Jim Garrison. Just willingly doing this out of the kindness of his heart, you know, volunteering his time, as it were.
You know, and just very briefly, people who knew that I had been investigating or reading up on researching the assassination of President Kennedy, when the movie JFK by Oliver Stone came out in 1991, they asked me what I thought about it. And there are a few places where he took artistic liberties, but it is historically accurate with a capital H and a capital A. There's much more to it than Oliver Stone was able to include in the movie, and that's where you come right in. But that's something that people should bear in mind, because he was, oh boy, Oliver Stone's crazy, and every linthead pseudo-journalist in this country, when something comes up, they say, calling Oliver Stone. I mean, he's become a almost vaudeville caricature for these pussheads, and you know, that is absolutely unfair. Go ahead, Marty.
Right. So continuing, after returning to Reading, Pennsylvania from the United States Army, Frankhauser began reading SPSDF literature. The FBI learned in early May 1959 that Frankhauser had two local Socialist Party, Socialist Democratic Front publications on his person. One was a small booklet entitled The Parable of Walter, reading again, The Parable of the Water Tank by the famed late 19th century American socialist Edward Bellamy, that the SPSDF distributed. He also had an SPSDF leaflet entitled Unemployment Hurts Everybody. Tellingly, Frankhauser wrote on the back of the leaflet, "It's too bad that too many socialists don't understand that the Negro means the end of both Western civilization, and that means the end of socialism, too." That doesn't sound like, real quick as an editorial aside, it doesn't sound like that Roy Frankhauser is too left-leaning in his position on black people in America. But continuing.
That's a very telling document. Go ahead.
Frankhauser then may have been genuinely interested in some of the policies of socialism, even as he fought integration. I mean, that once again, as an editorial aside, that has all the earmarks of a Gladio-type infiltrator. June 1957, just as Frankhauser was becoming involved in the left, a bizarre incident happened, which was soon reported to the FBI. During this time, Frankhauser was a regular at the local Civil Air Patrol and also participated in parachute jumping with the Berks County Parachute Club. On 30 June 1959, the Ranger team commander of the local Civil Air Patrol called the group the Pararangers. Now that must be a direct reference, real quick, to the earlier FBI report where he claims to be a member of a Pararanger outfit that was involved in rescuing downed pilots that had crashed over the continental United States. That must be a direct reference to that.
Lee Harvey Oswald was a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol unit commanded by David Ferry, a principal in the Garrison investigation and the JFK assassination. And the founder of the Civil Air Patrol was General, I believe his first name was Roy Byrd, who owned the Texas School Book Depository building.
That's right. Harold D. Byrd, Dryhole Byrd, was the founder of the Civil Air Patrol. I should note
Go ahead. I had the first name wrong.
Right. I should also note that another general, this one serving in the United States Army Air Corps, later the United States Army Air Forces, later in the United States United States Air Force in 1947, was a man by the name of E.B. Germany. And E.B. Germany later became a chief representative of Shell Oil in the state of Texas, and a very close friend of Dryhole Byrd. He was the chief of intelligence for the Civil Air Patrol during the Second World War. Continuing, reading again, During this time, Frankhauser was a regular at the local Civil Air Patrol and also practiced parachute jumping with the Berks County Parachute Club. On 30 June 1959, the ranger team commander of the local Civil Air Patrol, called the Para Rangers, telephoned the FBI to report a strange incident. Last weekend, the Civil Air Patrol had a practice problem in night tactics in preparation for the forthcoming exercises. The group was split up, and some of them attempted to infiltrate positions protected by the remainder of the group. Frankhauser was one of the men assigned to attempt penetration of enemy lines and was sent off alone. One of the men in the group reported to the captain, redacted. Unfortunately, we don't have his name because the FBI redacted it. Reading again. One of the men in the group later reported to Captain Redacted that he had been near Frankhauser when the latter apparently thought he was alone, because he suddenly, subject stood up, extended his clenched fist and shouted out loud, "I am now a member of the greatest army in the world, the United Armies of the Soviet Union," end quote.
It reminds me of Lee Harvey Oswald at the famous WDSU interview. And by the way, the radio interview is available in the Guns of November Part 1. People can hear it for themselves. And Carlos Bingas says, "Are you a communist?" He says, "No, I'm a Marxist-Leninist." And this was, you know, broadcast all over the country. I mean, this is great, great stuff. Go ahead.
Absolutely. This is a direct parallel to Mr. Oswald and what he's doing in his Civil Air Patrol unit. Continuing, yet another report on Frankhauser's statements to his Civil Air Patrol Pararanger comrades was reported by the same Civil Air Patrol commander on 31 March 1960. Once again, I would stress that this commander's name is redacted in the FBI report. This time he told the FBI, quote, "Subject is also reported to have told some of the other Rangers about a month ago that he would like to go to Cuba to join Fidel Castro." On this same occasion, which occurred when the Rangers were temporarily snowbound while out on an overnight hike near Hawk Mountain, Pennsylvania, he also entertained with the group some of the historical background of the White Russian Army and the Nazi army under Adolf Hitler. Interesting references and historical material that he's sharing with his fellow Civil Air Patrol cadre.
And he being Roy Frankhauser.
Correct. Yeah, okay. Seemingly he was well-versed in the history of the White Russian army and the stormtroopers under Adolf Hitler.
I can't imagine that would be the case. I mean, obviously, it makes only too much sense. Continue, Monty.
Right. Needless to say, all of this only reinforced the FBI's view that Frankhauser might well be insane because, quote, "he doesn't know his left from his right." Interesting. That's the exact same thing that the FBI would say about Lee Harvey Oswald after the assassination of President Kennedy, when they later learned that he fired upon General Edwin Walker. Well, to quote J. Edgar Hoover, "the man doesn't know his left from his right. He must be a nut."
And by the way, the evidence of Oswald shot at Edwin Walker is really, I would call it non-existent, but let's just say very flimsy.
Well, it's tedious to the point that it's completely non-existent, but continuing. As one FBI agent commented upon reading the report about Frankhauser's praise of Russia, quote, "The above action on the part of the subject seems to substantiate previous indications that he is mentally unbalanced," end quote. Yet Frankhauser's interest in both the Soviet Union and Cuba may have deeper roots. On 18 January 1960, the FBI received a report on Frankhauser carried out regular telephone conversations with one Fred Polzin of Parksburg, Pennsylvania. That's a last name spelled P-O-L-Z-I-N. Fred Polzin of Parksburg, Pennsylvania, located in Chester County, not from Reading, Pennsylvania. FBI report states the following, quote, "Redacted exhibited a few items which Roy had left lying around and several were from the aforementioned. Redacted. A letter addressed to Roy at Redacted home bore the return address of Redacted, Parksburg, Pennsylvania, a literary agent and importer of foreign publications. The letter proper, which is dated 11 January 1960, reads as follows. Redacted, thanks you for calling this evening. It is good to hear from one of our, from one with similar interests. I'm usually home after 5 Saturday afternoon and Sunday, but better call or drop a card before leaving to be sure. Enclosed is some printed matter materials. I hope to have a new booklet out within this week, redacted. Then the FBI report continues. Redacted stated that she had seen several items.
Hello, Monty?
Yeah, are you here? I got some interference. I don't know what's going on.
Hang on one sec. Let me restart the timer here. Let us sacrifice a Tootsie Roll at the altar of the gods of technology and hope that they smile upon us. They just found and tossed a couple of lightning bolts. Or maybe thunderbolts would be better. The name of the National Space Rights Party publication, as I recall.
Right. So continuing with this poiser that Roy Frankhauser is in contact with, reading again from the FBI report. Once again, this is a report dated 11 January 1960 on Frankhauser's activities and his publishing. Reading again, Redacted stated that she had seen several items from Roy got from Redacted, but could only find one, a leaflet from April 1958. Wright newsletter describes track number 5 advertising an article by Frederick Charles F. Weiss of Middleton, New York. Weiss is described as a German right-winger and mentions Western decadence, but only in terms of combating this decadence in order to defeat Russia. One copy of this leaflet is attached. She also recalled that one pamphlet was captioned Quae vadis homo, which she admitted she did not understand. She stated that Roy called Redacted one evening, but she had not overheard the conversation. Immediately afterwards, Roy Frankhauser called Redacted at the Redacted home. He told Redacted that he had talked to Redacted and that Redacted had seen Ku Klux Klan business and that had tried to call Roy. Redacted assumes that Roy Frankhauser was referring to the Ku Klux Klan publicity, which appears to be in the Reading Record some months ago. Roy told Redacted on this occasion over the phone that Redacted had stated that he had a printing press that they could use and had offered to help organize some of the publishing. Now, I'd like to make an editorial note here. This FBI report, even though all the names are redacted, clearly demonstrates that Roy Frankhauser is the chief of printing and publishing for the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Pennsylvania. That's the reason why I'm reading these redacted sections. Continuing, quote, according to Roy, Redacted said, when you get big enough, you can fight back, even if the paper learns of your organization, end quote. Now, it should be noted that Fred Polzin, the man that Roy Frankhauser had called in conjunction with the printing for the Ku Klux Klan, owned a printing press and regularly printed tracts by his friend Fred Weiss. This was public through the publications of the Ku Klux Klan in Pennsylvania in 1960. So we can infer from all these redactions that this is Roy Frankhauser is in fact central to the publishing of all of the Klan's literature in the northern parts of the United States of America in 1960. Interesting credentials for a leftist, no, Mr. Emery?
Oh, absolutely. And again, maybe people think that, I'm being a curmudgeon when I say there is no left. I mean, no, there is not. I mean, sure, plenty of the people who believe in those things are the proletarians in some of those organizations. But you take a look at the leadership, same thing is true of the right. But
Oh, well, that's what I'm trying to demonstrate here. Roy Frankhauser is not only doing all the printing for the Ku Klux Klan at the exact same time that his informant, George Payne, is doing all the editing for the Socialist Workers Party.
Yep. And again, Bernie Sanders ran for the for president on the SWP ticket in 1980. So continue.
Fred Polzin owned the printing press, and he regularly printed tracts by his friend Fred Weiss. Polzin also served as secretary of the Truth Seeker, which was a, quote, scientific racist and proudly atheist publication out of New York City run by Charles Lee Smith. Truth Seeker also held regular racist forums in Manhattan, which served as a part of a cover for meetings for the far-right National Renaissance Party, officially led by James Medol, but which had also bankrolled for a long time by Fred Weiss, the same Fred Weiss that is helping Roy Frankhauser do all the publishing for the Ku Klux Klan in Pennsylvania. So there.
Very quickly, a key member of the National Renaissance Party was Dan Burroughs, whose
absolutely
three-bullet suicide at Frank Hauser's farm we've spoken about. And Burroughs was a member of Edwin Walker's military unit previous to that. Good discussion, Fred Weiss, in the late brilliant Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parfiyaki and the Postwar Fascist International. Continue, Monty.
Not surprisingly, Polzin was also a member of the National Renaissance Party. Polzin regularly published and distributed Weiss's writings, while Truth Seeker issued the first English language American edition of Francis Parker Yockey's classic far-right manifesto Imperium in 1962, with support from Fred Weiss. I should note once again, Roy Frankhauser is doing all of the printing for Frank Rice, Weiss. So can we infer that Roy Frankhauser is one of the men that's publishing all of Francis Parker Yockey's work in 1962? You bet your bippy. Continuing. The Truth Seeker NRP network in New York served as a key connection for Roger Pearson's Northern League of Pan-European Friendship, whose American headquarters in Newport News, Virginia, also doubled as the headquarters of the Virginia White Citizens Council, of which Roy Frankhauser was an FBI informant for in 1964.
Fascinating. Continue, Monty.
Now, for the purposes of what we're trying to demonstrate, it should be noted what's most important about Roy Frankhauser's ties to Polzin is that Polzin, whose father the FBI discovered was a member of the Pennsylvania Communist Party in 1943, promoted the Weiss-Yockey argument that the radical right should align with Russia. And for those listeners that are not veteran listeners of the program, it should be noted that the National Reconnaissance Party held public forums in support of Castro's Cuba.
National Renaissance Party, continue.
The National Renaissance Party held public forums in support of Castro's Cuba. And the reason why they did that, what was in promotion of the idea that the Soviet Union also supported a third alternative, meaning that if the Soviet Union were to drop nuclear weapons on Western Europe, it would give the far right all of the reasoning to start a fascist coup d'etat here in the United States. So really, the cynical reasoning for Weiss and Roy Frankhauser and Polzin and the Virginia White Citizens Council and Roger Pearson, you know, the reason why all of these elements are supporting Castro's Cuba is because they see the phenomena of Fidel Castro taking over in Cuba as a way of luring, you know, read into this, listeners to this program and future listeners that are listening to this recording. They see the far right in the United States in 1962. They see the phenomena of Fidel Castro as a way of luring the Soviet Union into a thermonuclear war. And in the aftermath of that thermonuclear war with the United States, they will take over the United States of America in a fascist coup d'etat. That is the crux of what is going on here.
Absolutely. And, you know, very quickly, it dovetails with the cover story of Charles Manson's Helter Skelter, that after the nuclear war, they would take over.
Exactly. That is the whole essence of these Yockeyite elements supporting the Soviet Union in Cuba through Roy Frankhauser's publishing house, ostensibly not only acting as an FBI agent, but apparently as a United States Army deep cover agent infiltrating the Socialist Workers Party. This has, in my opinion, all of the leanings, and you'll have to correct me here, Dave Ermey. You're gonna have to, you know, spank me on the hinder if I'm wrong here. Correct me if I'm wrong. This has all of the leanings of a Gladio type organization here in the United States of America.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing I want to recall for people in some of our earlier discussions, we talked about Falange from the book Alan Chase, International Hispanic or the Fascist Network. The headquarters of the Falange in the Americas was Havana, Cuba. And where do you think they went when Castro took over? Continue, Monty.
Well, I don't know if we need to go any further than this, but ultimately, I'd like to demonstrate some, very fascinating connections between Roy Frankhauser and the Ku Klux Klan, and ultimately some of the publishing houses that he is working with while he's acting as an FBI informant. Ultimately, while his other informant, his other buddy that he had groomed in the 82nd Airborne, who's going under the cover name Payne, through the Socialist Workers Party, it should be noted that the FBI found a long list of books inside of Roy Frankhauser's house in Reading, Pennsylvania. One of them was had a very fascinating sort of quasi-leftist slant to it, but I'll just read the entire manifest of documents that were found in Frankhauser's house and their interesting connections to the old right, meaning the old Nazi party, if I may.
Go ahead.
One of them was the Economic and Philosophical Manuscript of 1844, a critique of the Galtha program, which was the origin of private family, private property in the state, as well as on capital, the Revolutionary Act, military insurrection and political economic action, which was an Engels pamphlet published by the Socialist Labor's Party and New York News Company. Other tracts included Socialism Answers and Underneath Anti-Semitism, which was published by Socialist Labor Party Eric Haas in 1893. Another one was Economics for Beginners by John Creecher, the founder of the Proletariat Party of the United States in the 1920s, whose members later ran for the famed U.S. radical publisher Charles Kerr and Company. And after returning to Mountain Spring, Frankhauser also attended a local SWP function, like the Militant Labor Forum held at 1303 West Garden Avenue, which doubled as a headquarters of the Benjamin Franklin Masonic Lodge of the Rosicrucian Order, of which the SWP apparently rented space for talks. It should be noted that when Lee Harvey Oswald is busy setting up his Fair Play for Cuba Committee headquarters at 513 Lafayette Place, which shared a corner building office with Guy Bannister's 544 Camp Street, it should be noted that one of the purported areas that Guy Bannister was debriefing his leftist insurgents was inside of the Masonic Lodge of New Orleans, just down the street from his office. So that's not to imply, crypto-fascist nomenclature or narrative that we get about, oh, secret Masonic lodges being used to take over the United States. That's simply to say that the structure of these organizations allows right-wing organizations to cover up their activities and to legitimize them while they're infiltrating the left. And I would stress, where do we see a parallel to that structure? Well, the Propaganda Due organization, of whose core leadership is the Gladio network in Italy in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s.
And by the way, the P2 logs discussed at great length throughout the archives of For the Record and Anti-Fascist Archives, in particular AFA programs 17 through 21 will give you an exhaustive analysis and presentation of same. Go ahead, Monty.
Absolutely. I'd like to stress once again, I'm not delving into LaRouche territory by stating that, it's a bunch of, secret Freemasons that are controlling everything. No, I'd like to make it very clear for the audience. These are right-wing paramilitary fascists that are using Masonic lodges to cover up their activities. I mean, it's a really brilliant theorem that more or less plays into the old Black 100s narrative that came out of, let's face it, Tsarist Russia at the end of World War One. The old stab in the back theory, that a group of, Judeo-Bolshevik, Masonic Jews had stabbed the white Russian army and the Germans in the back after World War One, and that's why they lost the war. This is simply an extension of that really sinister far-right propaganda that came out of the fledgling German Workers Party and the fledgling elements of the Nazi Party in the 1920s and 30s.
Interjecting very quickly, the Masonic lodges were also used to great effect as a cover for Confederate intelligence in the American Civil War, and the General Albert Pike of the Confederacy, a high-ranking Confederate military intelligence officer, also developed many of the rites for North American Freemasonry. The book, Come Retribution, I don't remember the author's name offhand, talks about the use of Masonic lodges by Confederate intelligence for their purposes. This is not to subscribe to the, you know, right-wing conspiracy theories, you know, the Masonic, you know, conspiracy, blah, 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 blah. But it is something to take note of.
Right. Now, how are all these connections with the Socialist Worker Party, Masonic lodges, Young Socialist League, and even some of the forebearers of revolutionary Marxism in the 1800s, you know, how is this all structural, in my opinion, and what is certainly the thesis of this program? How is this all structural to giving cover to a Gladio-type organization here in the United States? Well, one truly has to ask themselves how Roy Frankhauser could believe that a membership card in the Young Socialist League and ultimately a letter to the head of the Socialist Forum in the University of Iowa would be of any value to the FBI. Remember, that's the information that he gives to the FBI when he's purportedly working as an investigator for Jim Garrison in 1967. Remember all that information I presented earlier? Well, it may be, and this is a working theorem, it may be that Frankhauser thought that by proving he had some connection to the New York Socialist Workers Party in the 1950s, he could sell a more convoluted story about a leftist plot to kill Kennedy. I mean, ultimately, once again, this is the function of Gladio organizations in Europe in the 1950s and 60s, it was far right agitators and military intelligence personnel that were building up their leftist bona fides. Then they conduct terrorist operations in which people are murdered, and then they blame it on the far left. You know, that has all the earmarks of what Frankhauser is doing in 1967 by establishing these leftist bona fides. As a point of fact, in February 1964, right around the time that Frankhauser claims he was approached by the FBI and the Warren Commission, a far-right leader and virulent anti-Semite, Revelio P. Oliver, published the first of a two-part series of articles in which the John Birch Society journal American Opinion, wittily entitled Marksmanship in Dallas, which is spelled M-A-R-X-M-A-N-S-H-I-P, meaning, Marx, like Karl Marx. He published an article in American Opinion called Marksmanship in Dallas, where Revelio P. Oliver tried to argue that Kennedy was killed by a communist plot. Frankhauser may have believed, and once again, this is my own editorial aside on this, Dave. Frankhauser may have believed that those two pieces of paper showing his connections to the Socialist Workers Party in New York would finally be found in June of 1967, where they would act as a passe parote of sorts that would open up all doors and allow him to spin the grim of a conspiratorial Marxist murder mayhem for one and all. It is also possible that Frankhauser really did think that a Lee Harvey Oswald, if not the real Lee Harvey Oswald, had met with his informant through the Socialist Labor Party, meaning George Payne, which I believe that in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, Frankhauser was simply mistaking the reports of Michael Payne with his informant, George Payne. But it is a fact that Frankhauser was claiming that Lee Harvey Oswald was in contact with a Mr. Payne, which I don't know if this is Frankhauser trying to confuse the FBI any more than it is that Frankhauser just got so far up his own rear end that he couldn't realize what he had, and he really had a tiger by the tail here. But it is a fact that given these bizarre connections to the Central Committee of the Socialist Workers Party, that his future connection with his connection with George Larrabee, aka George Payne, Larrabee was, or excuse me, Larrabee, excuse me, you know, the informant that he has within the Central Committee of the Socialist Workers Party of New York, was later married to a woman who would soon become Lyndon LaRouche's common law wife, Carol LaRouche.
Oh
now,
man,
I don't.
did she pass away? Did was it that I think was it wasn't Helga Zeplerush his wife at one point?
That's right. That's the same Carol Larrabee who was married to George Larrabee back in 1961. Now, I don't know what to make of that other than to say it describes a very bizarre far-right continuity of disinformation going from Ravello P. Oliver right up to when he's working for Lyndon LaRouche. You know, it's a very bizarre continuity.
Again, I have a question. I'm confused. Is Carol LaRouche the same as Helga Zeplerush, or are they two different wives or common law wives?
No, it's the same person, just changed her name.
Oh, okay. Very good. And I should say very good, but as my late dear friend Mae Bussell would have said, oh, my ache and a blank blank. Go ahead.
Ultimately, all of this machination between Ravello P. Oliver, Carol LaRouche, you know, his informant within the Socialist Workers Party, George Payne, a.k.a. George Larrabee, all of this has all the earmarks, in my opinion, of establishing false flag bona fides of Lee Harvey Oswald to the Socialist Workers Party, and in turn elements of the fledgling American or I should say, you know, the American Communist Party, and ultimately, you know, the continuity of interests, as it were, of the conspiracy theories that are promoted by the far right in this country, of which Lyndon LaRouche is a functionary, or I should say was a functionary of. And the fact that Frankhauser is feeding this information to LaRouche in the 1970s is fascinating. You know, he's feeding this whole narrative to him that Lee Harvey Oswald was in fact a leftist, you know, and he had all these bona fides to prove it through his FBI informant, you know, George Larrabee, aka George Payne. You know, it's just so disturbing, but this is the reality of what Frankenhauser is doing. You know, he is in fact laying the groundwork for a false narrative surrounding Mr. Oswald. It should be noted, and I mentioned this in not the previous program, but the one before it, that Roy Frankenhauser was connected to a man within the Ku Klux Klan by the name of Robert Shelton, who seemingly ran counterintelligence operations for the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Pennsylvania, okay?
And now, I like Frankenhauser because it really is kind of appropriate. The fact that the name is Frankhauser, but now Robert Shelton, wasn't he also someone who was networked with Joseph Adams Neeltier of the National States Rights Party?
100% correct. He was. In fact, he acted as the, according to FBI files, Robert Shelton acted as the private security, or I should say personal security agent of, for Pete's sake, you just mentioned his name.
Joseph Adams Neeltier.
Neeltier, correct. He acted as the personal bodyguard for Neeltier at one point.
And Neeltier was actually, I just want to fill listeners in. He is discussed in The Guns of November, Part 4, and in other programs, the AFA program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Neeltier was taped, again, a member of the National States Rights Party, part of this domestic gladio milieu that we're talking about. But he was taped by an undercover Miami police informant. And he was discussing not only assassinating John Kennedy, but Martin Luther King from a high-rise building using a rifle with telescopic sights. This is well before. This was actually, I think, in the early November of 1963. He also, interestingly enough, linked that with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, a very famous atrocity in the American Civil Rights Movement, in which the 16th Baptist Church and 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, was blown up, killing four young black women. And Neeltier was actually in Dealey Plaza, I believe, on 11-22-63, However, he was killed when I believe a kerosene lantern or some sort of camping lantern exploded and burned him to death, so he wasn't available for subsequent investigations like the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Continue, Monty.
All of that is correct. And thank you for that editorial aside, because I'd like to pivot our attention to a book that was written by the late Kevin Coogan. It's called The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, The Mystery of Mikhail Golininsky and the Far Right International. And if I may, I'm just going to quote the section of the book in its entirety.
Yes,
this is from
I think the guy's name was Mikhail Golininsky. I think that's the correct pronunciation.
Correct.
A fascinating and if the term enigmatic ever applied to anybody, it's the late, not so great, Mikhail Golininsky. Go ahead.
Right. So I'm quoting from a section of the book. This is, I'm actually reading from the Kindle edition, but it's chapter 12, White Russians in Manhattan. And this is talking about some of the background of a man by the name of Charles Pitchall, who was a member of the American Steering Committee of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini, Pennsylvania. note that we've been talking about Pennsylvania all morning.
But the regular Knights of Malta are also fascinating and with more connections than a switchboard. But I think their actual name is L'Ordre Souverain et Militaire des Chevaliers de Saint-Jean de Jerusalem in French. And the Knights of Malta are very, but that's the official Vatican network. This is a competing and very possibly overlapping network. Continue with Charles Pichel. The last name is spelled Pichel.
All right. So, reading from The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, The Mystery of Mikhail Golininsky. This is chapter 12, White Russians in Miami. I'm reading from the Kindle edition, so this would be page 256. So, reading.
Excuse me for interrupting. Miami or Manhattan?
Manhattan. Thank you, Manhattan.
Go ahead.
So, White Russians in Manhattan. Reading again. Quote, on 15 July 1933, Pichel wrote to Ernst Punzi Hoffenstangl, who ran Hitler's Foreign Press Bureau in Berlin. Declaring himself director of the American Heraldry Society, Pichel offered to serve as Hitler's personal liaison to America. An officer, Hoffenstangl, prudently declined.
Oh, by the way,
the network...
filling in very quickly, because that's not a name familiar to the listener. Ernst Putzi was his nickname, P-U-T-Z-I, which in German means little fellow. It was ironic because he was sort of like 6'6". Ernst Putzi Hoffenstangl, who claims to have invented the Sieg Heil salute, which he learned from his time at Harvard University, attending Harvard University football games. So that's the guy we're talking about here. Continue, Monty.
That's right. The network around Pichel also functioned as a propaganda outlet for Witdienst, or the World Service, which was a German-based far-right network that relentlessly pumped out anti-Semitic propaganda in 8 foreign countries. Now, this is, I should note that the late Kevin Coogan is quoting directly from the official history of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini. Quote, so this is their own publication. So it's a rather dubious source, but this is the source that Kevin Coogan quotes in his book. Quote, in 1933, Pichel had contacted Germany through Hitler's friend Pussy Hoffenstangl in an effort to become the German chancellor's personal representative in the United States. These Russian and American nationalists were now coordinating their anti-Bolshevik publishing activity with Ulrich Schlesienhauser's Witdienst through the offices in Erfurt, Germany. German Lieutenant Ulrich Schlesienhauser was in charge of this Witdienst publishing concern, which inherited the campaign of the American Anti-Bolshevik Publishing Association of Chertith Spindlerwisch.
Bobby, interrupting, if you would spell those last two names involved with the German Weltdienst for us.
That's last name, Fleischhauer. That's F-L-E-I-S-C-H-H-A-U-E-R.
I think that's pronounced Fleischhauer. Go ahead.
Okay, Fleischauer, and then the White Russian prince that's mentioned, his last name is spelled Cherep hyphen Spindovich.
That's who I thought you were talking about. Go ahead.
Translated as the World Service, and known before this time in France as a Service Mondrial, the SOSJ, that's the Sovereign Order of the St. John Jerusalem Shikshini, publishing effort had actually started in 1904 by Prince Sherpip Spindrovich in Paris. At that time, it was called Angris Latine. When the Paris operation of Prince Sherbet Spindrovich was exposed by the Bolsheviks in 1919, he was able to convince Henry Ford to succeed him in the Dearborn Independent. The German agency, Weitdienst, had originated in Hamburg, where it was published as a journal called the White Cross in 1920. The Baltic Germans of the Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini in Pennsylvania, to include Fleischhauser and Markov II, another White Russian prince, had originated the anti-Bolshevik journal sharing information with Sherpip Spindrovich. Eventually, Weitdienst's operation came under the administration of Alfred Rosenberg after the death of Tsar Kirill I, but the operations continued in Erfurt, Germany.
Fill us very quickly in as to who Alfred Rosenberg was.
Well, he was a White Russian revolutionary that served in between 1919 and 1925 as the head of the German-Russian steering committee of a pro-fascist White Russian organization called Aufbau, or the Reconstruction. He later became the chief publisher for the German Workers' Party, and by the time the German Workers' Party spawned with the German Socialist Rights Party, becoming the fledgling Nazi Party in 1931, Alfred Rosenberg was the commander of the Ostministerium, which oversaw the genocidal campaign of Operation Barbarossa, and effectively Alfred Rosenberg was commander of all of the Einsatzgruppen mobile death squads on the Eastern Front, which liquidated 20 million men, women, and children during the Second World War.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
The Alfred Rosenberg we're referencing here.
The Third Reich's top Eastern Front official.
Is also the head of publishing for the Dearborn Independence of Weitdienst Publications in 1930.
The Dearborn Independent, that was the anti-Semitic newspaper founded by Henry Ford.
And I should note that this is conducted through one of Alfred Rosenberg's lieutenants, a man by the name of Boris Brazel, who is a very close representative of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem Shikshini under Charles Pitchall.
And is generally believed to have been one of the conduits channeling the American industrials Henry Ford's money to Adolf Hitler. He's discussed in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, recapped in For the Record 511. Continue, Marty.
Correct. Continuing with the book, The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, by the late Kevin Coogan. In America, according, once again, this is I would stress, this is an editorial from me, not Kevin Coogan. This is coming from the official histories of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini. So consider the source. But it's a rather interesting entry. In America, according to the official histories of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini explains that the White Russian prince Anastase Volskinsky, last name spelled V-O-N-S-I-A-T-S-K-Y, and Howard Bornstrup, last name spelled B-R-O-E-N-S-T-R-U-P-P, led the fledgling White Russian Nationalist Field Force in Miami, Florida. Paul Winter of the OSJ, longtime associate of Grand Chancellor Pitchall, and former Ku Klux Klan leader from New York and Philadelphia, was involved in the American Nationalist League. This group network was, or excuse me, this growth of this network, quote, accumulated from a vast propaganda arm headed by Alfred Rosenberg and worked against the international conspiracy from government-run offices and the German Third Reich throughout World War II. Besides Prince Markov II, last name spelled M-A-R-K-O-V, the Baltic Germans, Ulrich Fleischhauser, and Schaubrick Bork and Alfred Rosenberg, Findor Winberg, and Eugene von Engelhardt of the Frickbund, that's spelled F-I-C-H-T-E hyphen Bund, were among those active in the disinformation campaigns through the Dearborn Independent until the closing days of World War II. All over Europe and the United States, small print shops produced information which distributed at cost an effort to stay, at cost an effort to stay the spread of militant socialism. As an editorial, I should like to note this is exactly what Roy Frankhauser is doing as the chief publisher of the Ku Klux Klan in Pennsylvania. You know, he's trying to incur militant operations with the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Pennsylvania in 1962. This is exactly what Alfred Rosenberg and Charles Pitchall are doing in the state of Pennsylvania in 1931. You know, some 30 years earlier. Continuing with the spy who would be Tsar. The headquarters of the centralized education campaign during the lifetime of Tsar Kryl I was in Erfurt, Germany, the home of these printing presses run by Rosenberg. Until his death in 1938, the Grand Duke Kryl had been the chosen candidate of Adolf Hitler for Tsar of Russia when the Soviet Union was defeated.
Fascinating.
Continuing, mimicking Volkdienst, the Americans had established their own propaganda operation. One of the leaders was Robert Edward Edmondson, yet another defendant of the Washington sedition trials of 1944. From the official histories of the Knight of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini, we find the following entry on him. Quote, the American Grand Prairie also restarted this propaganda in the United States in 1936 when it was called the Edmondson Economic Service. Charles Pitchall operated a similar information service for the SOSJ called the Crux News Service from Leona, New Jersey from 1939 to 1945. Due to pressure from the United States government and from the press, both Edmondson and Pitchall moved the orders operations into the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in 1945. The efforts was to expose a Jewish-controlled world conspiracy considered by many as anti-Semitic, were continued by the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini, in the early 1950s. Thereafter, it became politically and economically impossible due to the use of the court system by the quote-unquote liberal establishment. It should be noted as an editorial that this is the exact same milieu I will demonstrate very soon, the exact same milieu that Roy Frankhauser is conducting his publishing for the Ku Klux Klan and the National Renaissance Party in 1962. And I will demonstrate that link, but I must continue with the connections of Pitchall to the far right and the Nazi Party, if I may, Mr. Emery.
Oh, okay. But the only thing is we might want to continue that in 2 weeks. I really want to get to COVID. I guess it's called COVID operations, because that is so important and not at all separate from the things we're talking about. Go ahead, Monty.
Well, on that note, since we're running out of time on this narrative here and how you want to wrap it up, I'll just state this much for the record on what this represents ultimately to Roy Frankhauser and his connections to this whole milieu established by Charles Pitchall before, during, and after the Second World War with Alfred Rosenberg in tow. It should be noted, and I'm going to the reference section of this book. One moment, let me pull it up here. This is the reference section of the same book that I'm referencing by Kevin Coogan. Once again, this is A Spy Who Would Be Tsar, The Mystery of Mikhail Golinitsky and the Far Right International. Reference section to all of this is can be found for this chapter. Once again, this is the chapter White Russians in Miami. This is reference 157 and 158 of this book, okay? And I'm just going to read it in its entirety. Waldienst was founded by Fleischenhauser and Grigor de Corte. That's a Kalgua operative. There may have been a journal called the White Cross, and this is Kevin Coogan speaking.
And by the way, the Cagoule was the French right-wing fascist terrorist group we've spoken of in the past. We've got just over 4 minutes left.
Okay, so this is once again Kevin Coogan speaking and his editorial. There may have been a journal called the White Cross, but if so, it predated Waldienst. In 1939, Alfred Rosenberg moved Waldienst to Frankfurt, Germany. Neither Fleischhauser nor Prince Markov were Baltic Germans. More on Waldienst can be seen in Hagenmeiser's book and Plots and Templars' books, The Far Right and the White Russians. And that's published in 2017. And Plots Templars' account is published in 2013. Now I'm skipping to entry 158 in this book. Winter and the Knights Security General is listed in Pitchall's History of the Knights as Masters of Ceremony and Lecturer, President of the Law Enforcement League of Pennsylvania, Life Member of the International Police Association of the State of Pennsylvania. Now, why is that so important? The next entry demonstrates it. The Knights of St. John of Jerusalem's Security Chief under Charles Pitchall in 1962 is Eugene Tabbitt, last name spelled T-A-B-B-U-T-T, who ran all counterintelligence operations for Robert Shelton's Ku Klux Klan operations in Pennsylvania in 1962, at the exact same time that Roy Frankhauser is running all of the publishing for the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Pennsylvania. So here we have a direct continuity, Mr. Emery and listening audience, with Alfred Rosenberg, Charles Pitchall, Boris Brassall, right through the publishing arm of Charles Pitchall's Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, through the Ku Klux Klan of the state of Pennsylvania, right to Roy Frankhauser as the chief publisher for the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Pennsylvania in 1962. These are structural Third Reich connections that Frankhauser has through Charles Pitchall's Knights of St. John of Jerusalem organization.
And again, one of the denazification of Germany, as spoken about in T.H. Petten's The New Germany and the Old Nazis, is simply a myth. And beyond that, America was not denazified at all. And that's one of the reasons we are in the situation that we are in.
So ultimately, I would argue that the elements that are behind the murder of President Kennedy, when you mention people such as who is the Klansman that you just mentioned earlier that was working with Robert Shelton,
Joseph Miltier.
Joseph Miltier, correct. Thank you. Ultimately, when you mention him having foreknowledge of the assassination, what is he really representing? This is simply a continuity of Third Reich Ostministerium connections to the murder of President Kennedy. This is a continuity of interests. It was the Nazis that won the Second World War, and they did not win it on 5 May 1945. They won it on the 22nd of November 1963.
Yes, they did, and the American Civil War ended on that same date, and the South won. Mommy, we are all out of time, and I just want to commend you on a brilliant job here. One thing we're going to be doing is annotating the sources. We're behind doing that. We will be doing that in the future.
Absolutely.
In the comment section. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1340, Conversations with Moppy. This is conversation number 14. This is being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2024. For Moppy, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.